9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say.
Say
hands to kiss and babies to shake. But
you know, I think my record speaks for itself.
That's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in our beautiful St. Louis studios is
Joe Manis.
And our very special guest from a little ways out west.
Yeah, Robert Cornejo.
A state representative from St. Charles County. He also represents parts of Lincoln County as well. Thank you for driving all this way to be on our show today.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, my friends always say I have a face for radio.
So. Oh, well, I guess we all do. That's why we're in a radio studio now. So we always ask people who are on for the first time just what their district is. So could you just kind of tell our listeners what area you represent?
Yeah, so I represent the 64th District in the House of Representatives, which is basically northwestern St. Charles County and southeastern Lincoln counties. I live in the St. Peters portion, kind of northern St. Peters. I also get portions of northern O'Fallon, shoots across northern St. Charles County, gets the little towns of Flint Hill, Josephville, and St. Paul. Also gets the northern parts of Wentzville and goes up into southeastern Lincoln County and basically goes to the Troy city limits without actually going into Troy.
Now tell us a little bit about yourself, including the all-important question.
Which is where you went to high school. We've even asked like Emmanuel Cleaver that question at this point.
Actually, we got some good answers. So.
Well, yeah. You know, I was born and raised in North St. Louis County. Grew up pretty poor. You know, we bounced around from housing, apartment complex. Every year, you know, I've lived in Florissant, Ferguson, Hazelwood. My parents to this day still live in Blackjack. Went to Hazelwood Central for high school.
Okay.
Then I went off to college at Washington University in St. Louis, and then I went off to law school at Mizzou, and my wife's from St. Charles County said she had to move back to St. Charles
now,
County.
Now, before the show, you were talking about how you were in a pretty powerful law school class. Can you just tell our listeners who else was in the University of Missouri School of Law class of 2008.
Yeah, so our graduating class, I think we were right about 142 graduates out of that class. And out of that class, there's, you know, me and then Elijah Haar, who's a state representative from Southwest Missouri, the Springfield area. There's also Representative Caleb Jones from the Columbia area. The new Deputy Director of Agriculture, Daryl Chapman, is also there. There's basically eight of us in the state capitol.
It's just really? Amazing.
Yeah. No, that is amazing.
There's Jay Atkins, who was a lobbyist for the chamber. Now he's with, I believe, Hush Blackwell. Mm-hmm. And then Sean Fury, who was Senator Schmidt's chief of staff, and who's now over with Centene, I believe. And
so was there, like, poison in the water that made you all go into politics or something like that?
Well, you know, politics was something I always been in my blood. You know, during college, I worked for Senator Jim Talent. In his St. Louis district office.
I think that's when I first met you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I loved my time there. I had a great time. Then, you know, with I think part of it is just Columbia is so geographically close to Jefferson City that, you know, you're bound to run into some of that and have some experience. And I guess it got into our blood.
Yeah. So you first ran for office, I think, in 2012, assuming you didn't run for, like, Troy City Council or anything before then. I think it was kind of a new House seat. I don't think it had an incumbent. And you actually ran against former State Representative Wayne Hanke of Troy. Yep. So what was it like running in a race where you were like the relative newcomer versus this grizzled Lincoln County political superstar, basically?
Yeah, you know, you're correct. It was the first office I had ever run for. So I was kind of, you know, doe-eyed going into it all. But, you know, I just put my head down, worked. I think, looking back, I knocked over the course of, you know, the summer and fall, I knocked over 17,000 doors. There were some people that were, I went back and calculated, it was the seventh time I knocked their door. They were just sick of seeing me. So I think they
told
me
that can be dangerous. You can lose votes.
Exactly. I think some of them just told me, yes, you got my vote, just so I'd leave them alone. You know, and I just put my head down and worked. And it was quite a contrast, you know, not just Republican, Democrat, and where we stood on the issues, but also at the time I was 29. I think Wayne was 71 at the time. He had experience. He had a voting record. And there were several doors where I knock on, they look at me kind of sideways and ask me how old I was. And
not to get too in the weeds here, but didn't he only have like one term left in the House, essentially, or two terms left? Or...
He had served two terms. He served from 02 to 06, and then he ran
for both state Senate,
in both a special and a general against Scott Roop and lost.
Lost both times. Yep. Just to clear that up for us. So you've been in the House now for about, 3 years or so? What have been kind of the areas of expertise that you've kind of found a niche in?
Yeah, so I'm chairman of civil and criminal proceedings. You know, I'm an attorney. As my background, I own a law office with, you know, two business partners, an associate, four staff, four offices across the state. So, you know, kind of legal issues are my background. And so that's why I was, you know, appointed by the speaker to be chairman of civil and criminal proceedings. And that's kind of where my niche is right now.
Now, I'm interested in your take on sort of what happened with Deal, and particularly since you are a lawyer and you know some people who are in the same law firm as he is, and the whole atmosphere, because that's sort of, I think it's gotten more attention than it deserves in relationship to, not because of the incident, which is awful, but in relationship to what would happen that last week, because actually I think a lot of the stuff would have happened anyway because of what was going on in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So that's my backdrop here. But I'm interested in your take on that. And were people surprised?
You know, there had been rumors floating out for a few weeks. But then I think some people thought, you know, this was something that was going to come up after session.
Okay.
Where, you know, I knew some reporters were digging around and eventually maybe something would come out. You know, and it was just an unfortunate and sad incident. You know, I think John accepted responsibility for what he did, and he also accepted the consequences by not only resigning his speakership, but also his seat as state representative. And, you know, it threw our caucus for a loop, and that's why I think it's important for our caucus to kind of come back together and become stronger and more unified.
Now, there was recently an article in the Post-Dispatch about, you know, there was some ambiguity about whether he was going to resign, but state representatives Jay Barnes and Paul Kirtman took kind of a leadership role in pushing it into a new direction. I know that caucus proceedings are considered secret, but was there a point when some younger members of the caucus kind of took charge and said, we got to go into a new direction here?
No, that was one of my disappointments with caucus. And, you know, obviously a lot of this has become public, so I feel a little bit more comfortable talking about what happened in caucus. But basically, you know, we went for about an hour. Like you said, Representative Barnes stood up and asked for a vote. He appreciated that John accepted responsibility, but he also thought that, you know, being in leadership, maybe we should reconsider the vote. Mm-hmm. And have a new vote. Yes, Representative Mike Moon also seconded that motion, and then Representative Kirtman also stood up and said, you know, basically the same thing as Representative Barnes. But after about an hour, discussion was cut off and basically said, you know, I think we need to sleep on this before we make a rash decision. And I think a lot of the younger people were a little bit upset because they were waiting their turn to say something in caucus and letting the older.
So we're talking
members...
Wednesday night, correct?
Correct.
And when we're talking about younger people, there is this group, and I would include you in this, of, I would say, people who are aged like 25 to maybe 35 who, you know, have kind of either just gotten to the House or are kind of moving up in the House. Many of them have young families. Many of them, I think, are kind of taking a different posture and mentality toward the legislature than people who are maybe were elected in 2002. And I think that Representatives Barnes and Kirtman are definitely within that group, although I'm not sure how old either of them are. But, you know, that's kind of a backdrop for our listeners as well. But continue.
So, yeah, you know, obviously, you know, the consequences of what happened with John. But, you know, some of the things after talking with other caucus members, for example, my wife's a Lutheran grade school teacher. And Thursday morning before 8:30, she had already texted me saying, you know, I've already been questioned several times about this scandal. You know, it's kind of one of those where regardless of how I act down there, when stories like this break, my wife has to answer questions about whether I'm doing that same thing down in Jefferson City. And, you know, and it gets a little frustrating that, you know, I signed up for this. I'm willing to take the bullets and answer the questions and everything. But when, you know, I got my wife, who's a Lutheran grade school teacher, having to take these questions, that kind of gets.
And I'm sure some of other members of your caucus had to deal with something similar. Do you think that, you know, obviously he's resigned and it's kind of a moot point, but the thing that kind of struck me, because we're all both UM system employees and we have taken training on sexual harassment and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And regardless of, you know, how it happened or whatnot, we are kind of taught that, you know, even and taking into mind that John Deal was not maybe directly supervising interns, but like a superior subordinate relationship like that, even if it was consensual, it's just not appropriate. It would likely get people fired or severely reprimanded everywhere else. Was that kind of the thought process of many people in your caucus when this came out, that, you know, regardless of the circumstances, just wasn't appropriate for this to occur?
Correct. You know, and one thing, when we come into office, we have basically a discussion, a seminar, class, whatever you want to call it, on sexual harassment, what our policies are in the book. But other than that, that's about the only other time. Maybe, and I know Representative Engler from the Farmington area has been tasked by this new speaker, Richardson, to kind of revisit the policies. And, you know, I think there will be some significant changes coming, whether, you know, what that extent is, I don't know. I mean, obviously, this is such a fresh issue that, but I definitely think there are going to be some significant changes made.
Yeah, one of my points, I probably didn't make it very well, was that while this threw the House for a loop, there was this stuff going on in the Senate, or rather not going on, because of the paralyzation, because of right to work, so that even if the Deal thing had not happened, you guys probably would have been in the same legislative boat of not being able to get stuff through.
You probably would have been a lot less stressful for you guys, though. But
yeah,
continue.
Correct. But my point is that I'm wondering, did the Deal thing, how much impact did it have on legislation? My gut feeling is that it did not, but maybe it did.
No, I don't think it had really any effect on legislation. You know, we were stuck with, you know, we were purposely going to hold off on Senate bills to see if something were to, you know, if the levy were to break over in the Senate and they'd start passing House bills. But yeah, you know, as you saw towards the, if you were around on the last day of session when we started passing Senate bills, what we would have to do is strip off all the amendments that we made in the House and pass the underlying Senate bill just to get it on the governor's desk, or else it would die.
Yeah, and that's what happened on Friday.
Yeah, and that happened on Friday, and you could see the frustration coming out in our caucus that several times throughout the day, people would stand up on the floor and blow up because they were mad that all these Senate bills were getting through, and the Senate was the bad actor in this. And they're being rewarded for their bad punishment.
Is there any particular bills that were important to you that got caught up in this whole paralyzation?
No, you know, a lot of my legislation, except for one bill that I cared about, got through. You know, I'd also, one of the things I wanted to see addressed was the use of deadly force, you know, that I handled for a little while and handed off to Representative Alston on the floor. I think that was about the only other one that I would say I really wanted to see get done. There's also an issue floating out there dealing with the juvenile life without parole issue,
you know,
which was a Supreme Court case that basically has ruled our state law unconstitutional. And it's been about 3 years, and we really need to get something done with that.
Before we get to Senate Bill 5, I do have a question about deadly force that has kind of been gnawing at me. And maybe you can answer it more authoritatively because you're an attorney. There's been a U.S. court decision that basically sets up the baseline standards for how a police officer can use deadly force. So what would it matter what the Missouri statute is if you have to abide by the U.S. Supreme Court decision? Is it symbolic, or does it actually have any practical impact on policing?
Well, it does have a practical impact, but I don't think it's necessarily so much with policing as it is when you get into the trial and the jury instructions.
Yes.
And with the way the jury instructions read, there's kind of a question of, should the jury instructions read according to what the state statute says or based upon what this U.S. Supreme Court says?
And, I mean, some crimes are considered state crimes, I mean, as opposed to federal crime. So, I mean, do you run into that also, where you've got state law being counter to federal law, but on particular cases, the state law would apply?
You know, I think the U.S. Supreme Court case would apply to all of them.
That would be my guess, too.
Whether it's charged under state or federal crime. And so we really just need to clean up the jury instructions. Yeah.
So let's move on to a bill that did pass, Senate Bill 5. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was sponsored by Senator Eric Schmidt of Glendale, but you played a pretty big role in, I think, the conference committee part of the bill, which, you know, for most people that follow Jefferson City, is pretty much the most critical part of any wide-ranging comprehensive
bill. Explain for our listeners what Senate Bill 5 is.
You can explain it.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 5 actually started out as just changing one single word. Basically, with Senate Bill 5 is it's also called the Max Creek Law, which basically states how much can a municipality generate its revenue based off of traffic tickets. It originally started out, I believe, at 50% years ago, and then over the years it's been whittled down. At one point it was 35%, and I believe 2 years ago we changed it down to 30%. And so what Senate Bill 5 originally started out to is lowering everybody down to 10%, and that's what it just changed that one word from 30% to 10%. And then throughout the Senate and the House, it kind of morphed into this far-reaching bill that dealt with a lot of things. And
Yeah, some of the things that it deals with besides lowering the cap, which ended up being 12.5% for St. Louis County and 20% for the rest of the state, gets rid of failure to appear charges, limits fines to $300 for cities. It establishes municipal standards for St. Louis County, including the requirement that they have to have an accredited police department. A lot of other really consequential things that also deal in the civil rights realm rather than just the administrative realm of the cities, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Everything you just said, and also put in the law, you know, defendants cannot be detained in order to coerce payment out of them. It also puts the requirement that if an individual is arrested, whether with a warrant or without a warrant, sets time frames within which to get them in front of the judge, because, you know, some courts only meet once or twice a month, and you could have somebody sitting in prison, you know, in jail for 2 weeks,
yeah.
And that's, you know, basically a debtor's prison there, which is illegal.
Now, one of my key questions about this, and I've said this several times, is the fact that there's different percentage for St. Louis County than for the rest of the state on the restriction on how much of your city's income can come from that. Is that going to cause some legal problems? I mean, my gut feeling with that, it would, but I'm not a lawyer. You are. I'm interested in your take on that.
Yeah, you know, I guess philosophically, I agree. I think everybody across the state should be the same. But just as a reminder, you know, this is a Senate bill. It started out as a Senate bill. It started out in the Senate. It passed out of the Senate with this tiered system. And in discussions between the House and the Senate, it became pretty obvious pretty quickly that the tiered system was the only thing that was going to get through the system, both the House and the Senate. And so we kind of kept it at that. And you know, I understand the argument that, you know, we should all have the same system across the board. But when you start looking at the, you know, some of the where the problems are, a lot of it's St. Louis County.
Well, do you expect, though, to have some legal challenges, or might the governor actually refuse to sign over this? I've been hearing some rumors.
I have not heard any rumors about the governor refusing to sign. His office actually, you know, everybody wants to slam the governor for not being engaged in legislation. Uh-huh. Not him personally, but his office was engaged in this bill. You know, if the Municipal League or somebody else decides to sue,
it'll go to court.
It'll go to court, and I will probably file legislation next year to supplement anything that the courts, if court rules something unconstitutional, I'd be willing to come back immediately and fix that.
Now, I want to ask you a different question from a different angle. I talked with Brendan Rodiger, who is a St. Louis University law professor. And I just want to emphasize for you and our listeners, he likes a lot of aspects of Senate Bill 5, especially the getting rid of the failure to appear, limiting the fines and many of the other things. But one thing that he didn't particularly care for in this entire debate was the idea that a city's oppressiveness is related to its percentage of revenue that they get from fines. I'm going to play a clip right now and have you respond to it.
I have said all along that there are municipalities in West County that are just as bad as municipalities in North County, that using percentage of revenue to measure courts is an absurd measurement. What it really tells you is that a municipality is poor.
What he's kind of getting at is the fact that richer municipalities, for example, Ladue, has had well-established racial profiling issues that have been highlighted by the Attorney General, and also the fact that many of the richer communities that don't take in a larger percentage still take in a lot of gross dollars from fines. So I'd like you to kind of respond to that argumentation that maybe going with percentage was the wrong way of getting about at this issue.
Yeah, you know, I think another thing he may have been trying to touch on there is actually the kind of an issue that was been brought up several times during hearings during Senate Bill 5. It's kind of a tangential issue or something that's kind of been playing in the background is the St. Louis County pool tax.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that, you know, these monies are being transferred out to different cities, not staying in the city that where they're generated at. And, you know, for example, St. Anne, one of the big issues that people had was, you know, it seemed like as soon as Northwest Plaza shut down, which, by the way, I worked at for a year or two, you know, all of a sudden now they're out on the highway. And, you know, just whether there was impropriety or not, it just gave the appearance that, you know, they're just trying to make up for that lost revenue of what Northwest Plaza was generating for St. Anne.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, so what we're talking about is the pool versus point of sale on sales tax, and yeah. that right now you've got some St. Louis County municipalities that can keep all their money, mm-hmm. and then others, and actually there was a deadline, so any municipality that was formed after a certain date is in all or in the pool, and all that money is pooled together, and then each yeah. county gets, each city gets a certain amount based on population and other
but,
factors.
But getting back to the question, does this bill let wealthier municipalities that may have just as many problematic courts off the hook, basically?
One thing that lets it off the hook, you know, this bill, like we already talked about, doesn't just deal with percentages. You know, it deals with, you know, getting rid of the failure to appear on minor traffic violations, which is just a way for a municipality to just double, triple, quadruple fines and costs on the defendants. You know, and it deals with, you know, minimum standards for the St. Louis County that, you know, like we talked about, that there's different things that if you're going to be a municipality, then you've got to meet these standards.
Now, there's already been some talk that some of these communities that are going to be affected by this may shift to other ways, such as more being more aggressive in pressing fines for how a home is kept up or whether or not you're mowing your lawn or, you know, imposing fines on other aspects of their residents' lives because they don't have the traffic revenue. Mm-hmm. Is there any thoughts about that and what might be done, or is that considered a good thing?
Yeah, you know, I believe that was something that was brought up during a Senate hearing on Senate Bill 5, is that, you know, the municipality trying to get revenue is almost like a water going downhill. If you block off one path,
right.
it's going to go somewhere else to get the money, whether that's, you know, writing tickets for leaving your trash can out at the curb too long or whatever the case may be. And, you know, that's a legitimate point. You know, I think, you know, as a mayor going in when the 2008 recession hit, you know, you probably looked at three different ways. You know, we can either write traffic tickets to people from out of the city. We can start writing tickets for our own residents, you know, such as, you know, leaving your trash can out the curb too long. Or we can bring a tax to the vote of the people. But I can tell you what residents of the city probably would have guessed what you would want them to do is start getting people from out of town having to pay and make up the revenue.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if you're a municipality and you want to provide a service, then you ought to have the courage to go to the people and ask them, if this is the service we're willing to provide for this amount of money, are you willing to pay for it?
Yeah. Before we move on to another topic, one of the things I noticed is that this is a bill that many believe is ostensibly inspired by the unrest in Ferguson. Maybe because there were a lot of national media outlets during that time who highlighted, you know, real discrepancies in North County courts. But one of the things that I noticed is that Ferguson gets about 15-16% of its revenue from fines, mm-hmm. and they've already gotten rid of their failure to appear charge. And from talking with Mayor Knowles, they don't feel like they're going to have a problem getting to these standards. So is it a little bit ironic that this may not actually affect the city of Ferguson that much, but may affect surrounding towns a whole lot more?
Well, again, kind of like what Speaker Deal said at the beginning of the session, the House didn't have a Ferguson agenda. We, you know, any law that we apply, we try to apply to the whole state. And so, you know, I think when you start looking at some of the abusive practices, you know, and it's not just Ferguson. It's the whole, you know, people don't just live, work, and eat in Ferguson. They travel all around North County, all around St. Louis County. And, you know, when you got abusive practices in these courts all over the county, again, it's not something just to focus on what Ferguson did and has not done.
We'll be following the trajectory of that bill probably for years to come. But we wanted to talk about something that happened in another chamber, the eviler chamber, the Missouri Senate.
Yeah, and kind of the fallout. First of all, I just want to put a setup. Okay, one of the big issues that came up the last week was right to work, which for our listeners is a proposal that would bar employers or unions from requiring all workers in a bargaining union to pay dues. That's been a controversial issue. You've got several other states that have it, but labor has opposed it for various reasons, and some employers actually, some oppose it. So you're from the St. Charles area, which is kind of an unusual situation in that a lot of the Republican legislators in St. Charles, because they have large union populations, actually break from their caucus on that issue because they feel their constituents are opposed to it, so therefore they need to be. So I'm putting that as a backdrop for what happened in the Senate, where it already passed the House in February, and then it came up finally in the Senate early in the final week. There was a Democratic filibuster. Ron Richard, the former mayor of Joplin, who's now the Senate Majority Leader, who is a fan of right to work, managed to get to use a rarely used maneuver called moving the previous question, which in which you have at least half the Senate sign saying that they want to stop the debate. Okay, so the result was, because it's rarely used, it really upset the minority, which often happens. This happened when the Democrats were in the control years ago on another issue. But the point being is that then the Democrats then blocked any other action in the Senate, so it was frozen. So I'm putting that as a backdrop because here you are as a Republican who is in an unusual position of being opposed to right to work.
Correct.
So if you want to explain kind of how that affected the chamber and just kind of the backdrop.
Well, yeah, you know, kind of as you said, you know, when that was done on Tuesday, it pretty much shut down the rest of the session for the next 3 days. You know, I understand why people in my party want to bring it up. I mean, depending on what numbers you use, it's kind of funny, you know, depending on what numbers you use, either, you know, states are prospering with right to work, or if you're opposed to it, you bring up numbers that show, you know, that wages are lower in states that have right to work. But, you know, when you look at it, you know, a lot of the more rural areas or some of the areas that are on bordering the counties that are bordering right to work states, when you look at the county's population and income versus counties right across the border in the right to work states, it does increase. So, I mean, there are some legitimate arguments to support right to work. But like you said, you know, out in St. Charles County, literally right across the street from my district is the GM plant out in Wentzville. I was born and raised in a union household. My dad was a union electrician. He still is to this day. And what's happening is a lot of people from North St. Louis County, which, you know, North St. Louis County used to be union stronghold. I believe it still is today, are starting to migrate out to St. Charles County. And, you know, my high school friends and I joke that, you know, O'Fallon is Florissant West.
Yeah.
Because so many of us live out there that, you know, it's something that, you know, I'm going to listen to my constituents.
Well, I want to play a clip from somebody in Jefferson County, Senator Paul Wieland. I asked him if he was under a lot of pressure to vote for right to work, even though he was on our show and expressed a lot.
And he's a Republican.
He's a Republican from Imperial. This is what he said about, you know, the pressure from constituents, whether to vote against or for right to work.
When you go home and you go to the grocery store, you go to church, you go get gas, the people that come up to talk to me say, you guys aren't going to pass right to work, you're not going to vote for it, are you? No one has ever came up to me and said, Paul, we really need you to go up there and vote for right to work. It's just never happened.
So I want to ask you the similar question. Did you get a lot of pressure to vote for right to work, either from your constituents or from some key, you know, constituencies of the GOP? Or do you feel like you're in Senator Wieland's camp where it's overwhelmingly against it and you feel like you're comfortable voting against it?
Yeah. You know, with my district, the opponents of it are a lot more vocal than the supporters of it. But there are supporters of right to work in my district, and I have heard from them. And it's just one of those where, you know, ultimately I have to look at what's best for my district and how that plays in with the rest of the state.
Now, one of the things I'm interested in, and because you've probably heard a lot about this, is kind of the thought processes behind it. Because even without right to work, it doesn't require that an employer reach, you know, cut a deal with a labor union. And it doesn't require it. It just doesn't. I mean, right to work would bar it. Mm-hmm. Does that play into some of this? I mean, because you had some of the critics who were saying this actually it puts government in the middle of the labor business relationship. Others say, well, you know what others say, but I'm interested in your take on that. In other words, these little rural towns, it wouldn't necessarily affect them whether they have right to work or not.
Yeah, you know, that's some of the people in my caucus that voted against right to work, what they're saying is, you know, is supporting right to work is a Republican issue. It's not necessarily a conservative issue. When you got, government getting in between a contractual relationship between an employer and a group of employees, that's government interference, and that's not necessarily the conservative argument. And again, the counterpoint is that, again, if you look at the surrounding states and wages and population and where jobs are created.
So is there any scenario in the future where you would ever vote for right to work?
I could see it being a possibility. But again, right now, I've got a voting record of voting against it.
So who was pressing this? Because we knew, regardless of whether it's a Republican issue, conservative issue, is that there aren't the numbers in either chamber to override a guaranteed gubernatorial veto by Nixon. So was there any concern among you and other St. Charles colleagues about whether or not you even wanted it brought up, since you knew it, at the end of the day, it's not going to become law, at least not right now?
Well, I mean, this year it wasn't that big of an issue because we had already had a vote on it last year. The thought process in the House was, let's just get it through the House. I think we got it out in February. So
yes,
that way the Senate, we knew there was going to be some issues in the Senate, so get it to them as early as possible so that they can try to work through it as early
as possible.
Right.
You were already kind of on the record about that. But I'm curious how this issue, you're running for House Majority Leader along
yes.
with two other people, Caleb Rowden and Mike Searpoy.
Yep.
His last name is very hard to pronounce.
As is mine.
As is Cornejo. Is this impacting your run for Majority Leader at all? Or could it actually be a benefit because there are members of your caucus that oppose right to work, and maybe you're like the anti-right to work choice or something like that?
No, as I've been making my phone calls, kind of building my coalitions and gaining support, that has been the topic of a few discussions.
In what way?
People that support right to work want to know kind of where I stand on the issue. And especially in the veto override. And, I think Speaker Deal had a group of people that in our caucus that would be willing to take the vote and vote yes if it was going to make a difference and be the 109, get us up over to the veto override. But they weren't gonna do it if it was just a show vote and just, there to see where everybody's at. But if you're if we're really going to make a difference in state policy here, then let's do this. And so, in dealing with that, now that Speaker Deal stepped down, the chance to override is just that much smaller, just because
you have
one less seat and one less person who, had these discussions with everybody in our caucus. So, who those members are in our caucus that are willing to do that, I don't know exactly how many there are or what their names are, but I know there is a group in our caucus.
Are you among them?
It's something I would consider.
If it was 108 and they're waiting to get that 109, you'd be willing to do it.
I will not block a caucus priority, so I would be the 109.
Okay, that's news. So now, does this affect? I mean, within the Republican ranks, were the donors pressing some of this? Is this something that you're hearing from donors as well, or who do you think is pushing it the most?
I think it's the rural outstate legislators. I have not been contacted once by a donor.
Either
way, for or against.
Why do you want to be House Majority Leader? It seems like, obviously, it's a powerful position, but it seems like everyone, can get mad at the Majority Leader. Except I heard Todd Richardson was beloved by all for some reason. Are you trying to emulate him in that regards?
Todd's a once-in-a-generation politician. I can never fill his shoes, so I'm not even going to try to do that. But yeah, I think that's part of being a leader, is being willing to take the brunt of when people get mad and protect your caucus and do the things that, being willing to take the blame so that your caucus can move legislation forward.
Now, Joe, continue.
Well, first, can you explain to our listeners exactly what you would do as Majority Leader, just so they understand? And B, are there key issues for you for getting right to work? Are there other things that you would be that you think are going to make a difference in the contest?
Absolutely. So our floor leader basically has two roles. The first is he decides what legislation we go to on the floor. If we want to bring up House bills, Senate bills, whatever the case may be. But then also the second thing that's almost just as important is that our floor leader is also the head of what is our House Republican Campaign Committee, which deals with setting up our campaigns, recruiting, funding, and doing everything for the elections going forward. And so that, I think that's just as important as what happens inside the walls of the Capitol. And I think I've proven myself that, you know, I'm one of the top fundraisers in my class. I've been willing to spread the money out to the people. You know, in 12, I had a close race. In 14, I did not. So I was willing to, you know, I've proven myself that I'm willing to spread the money around and help out others where the cases need it. I've gone and knocked doors. You know, I've drove over to Kansas City a couple times during 2014 to knock doors and help bring home victories. And then, you know, as far as, you know, what happens inside the halls of the Capitol, I think I've proven myself pretty capable in taking the lead on Senate Bill 5 and being able to shepherd that through the process and being able to hold the House position. And actually, when the House first voted on Senate Bill 5, it had, I think, 131 votes. And then when it came out of the conference committee, we got 134 votes. So not only did we hold the House position, but we actually got some people to flip their votes and send a statement.
Now, here's a parting question before we let you go. We're looking way into the future here, like 2019, because it's assumed that Todd Richardson is going to be the speaker probably through 2018, you know, assuming that he wins re-election in his 90% Republican district and is elected speaker next time. But there doesn't seem to be like an obvious replacement for him. Is this kind of a situation where the winner of this majority leader race may become heir apparent to replace him? Or is it just, could it be just a wide open race once Todd Richardson departs due to term limits?
Yeah, you know, I think that's an important thing to consider when running for, when my caucus makes a decision for floor leader, because Mike Searpoy is in the same class as Todd Richardson. So if they choose him, then, you know, I think the speaker's race is going to become a complete free for all, and who knows, you know, where, you know, if somebody from my class were to, you know, the second term guys were to become floor leader, also the speaker pro tem's position is also going to be open up. So I know there's people from my class who are also going to look at that. That's also a way to become speaker. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you had asked me 5 years ago if I was going to be even a state representative, I probably would have told you, forget about it. You know, so for me to try to look 5 years out in the future, yeah, whether I'll be speaker or not,
we'll have you on in 2019.
Will you be looking at the Senate possibly? Yeah, at some point?
My House seat goes into three Senate seats, and honestly, none of them really line up for me very well. So
it's I guess majority leader or bust for now. But we'll make sure to have you on in 2018 for the 30-way speakers race that will ensue. Thank you so much for coming on our show. We really appreciate having you on. To close us out, you can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And you can follow the representative on Twitter at
Cornejo Formo, C-O-R-N-E-J-O, and then F-O-R-M-O.
And on that account, you can find out that he reads the same book to his children that I read to my son, a book about Grover telling you not to turn the pages of a book.
The monster at the end of this book.
Thank you very much. Until next time, so long.